This is Real Talk, the Customer Insights Show with Jen Vogel, a top-rated live stream and podcast in the market research and insights industry. We stream live on LinkedIn, Twitter, and YouTube, and you can listen on all major podcast channels. Join Jen and her guests for a weekly discussion around topics that will help you understand your customers better. Real Talk is presented to you by Vox PopMe, the leader in video research and ranked number one in qualitative research by Grit 2 years running. Here's today's conversation.
Hello, insights professionals, marketers, and everyone who wants to understand their customers better. I'm your host, Jen Vogel, and today I'm talking with the co-author of the new book, Influencing Shopper Decisions, Unleash the Power of Your Brand to Win Customers, Rebecca Brooks. Rebecca is the founder and CEO of market research consultancy, Alter Agents. She says that shopper promiscuity is on the rise, but market researchers are struggling to find insights. They are trapped in a framework defined by brand narcissism. Oh, I'm very excited to talk about this today. Welcome to the show, Rebecca.
Hi, Jen. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for coming on. I'm so excited to dig into this topic. A lot of, you know, I think bold conversation is going to come out of this. Really appreciate you being on. To kick us off today, can you tell our audience a bit about yourself, your career in the insights industry, and a bit about the work that the team at Alter Agents does?
Yeah, for sure. Thank you for that. So I founded Alter Agents in 2010. Prior to that, I was co-managing the LA office of Paul & Partners and had moved up through the ranks there when the LA office was founded, and then other stints at other market research companies. And the reason that I wanted to start Alter Agents, really kind of twofold. One is that I felt that the industry had a lot of models and frameworks and ways of looking at things that ultimately could impede insights in a way, and I wanted to try something different and fresh. And that work began in 2010 with Google's Zero Moment of Truth and has led to sort of this decade of shopper research that we've been doing. And the other reason was, you know, wanting to have a work-life balance and a culture in market research that I think is hard to find on the supplier side, that is, you know, kind of supportive of people's outside lives and takes good care of people from that perspective. So those are the two reasons I started the company. Very proud to say that we've been around for 12 years now, and really happy about the book coming out and getting to share all of these insights we've been gathering with people.
Yeah, that's really awesome. Interesting to hear, and I'm sure this will come out of it in our conversation, that there were some practices or, you know, ways of doing things that were in market research that was impeding insights. I'm interested to dig into that a bit deeper. So about the book and kind of some of the topics that are coming out of this this new book, is it out or coming out?
It's out. Yeah, it's out.
The book that is out, recently launched. Why are we seeing an increase in shopper promiscuity, and what does that mean?
Yeah. So let me first start off by defining shopper promiscuity, because promiscuity can be a challenging word. But what we mean by that is a willingness among shoppers to explore, experiment, and try new things. And it is leading to a different way that consumers are evaluating brands and even where brand comes into play for them during the shopping decision. So again, this was work that we did, apologies for the ringing. This was work that we started in 2010 with Google, and we were looking at, if you can believe it, back then, Google needed to make the case that people used search when making shopping decisions. So we helped them with that. And this was around the idea of people having a path to purchase, and where did search come in that path to purchase? And that's how we started the work. And then we continued working with clients, replicating that Zero Moment of Truth research. My partner, Devorah Rogers, and I did that work together. And what we saw was that, first of all, there was no path. Everybody took very different steps in very different orders, and were influenced by different things. So first of all, it was a much more complex story than marketers were hoping for. But in addition to it, we saw that there was an increase, right, in consumers' willingness to try something new and shoppers being excited about new things. And really, there are a lot of reasons for this, but to ultimately break it down into some major forces that have been leading to shopper promiscuity. The first is innovation. We have become accustomed to innovation. We now assume that things will have been different since the last time we're in the market. Whether I'm buying a toaster oven to replace the one I bought 10 years ago, I'm going to assume that there have been significant updates in the toaster oven technology, and I'm going to look to see what's new rather than going out and buying the same brand that I had before, even if I liked it. But the same is also true in something like pancake mix, where if you think about the pancake mix section of the aisle 10 years ago, there was, you know, a few major brands, but now there's gluten-free and protein-based and all sorts of different kinds of mixes and formulations. And so even something that simple requires the shopper to look and to think about what's new. So innovation is training shoppers to go into a category expecting there to be something new. And then they want to see what that is. They want to explore that. In addition to that, obviously, distribution channels, how we can access things, how we can intercept a brand or come across a brand in our shopping process, that's all wildly exploded. And so we're finding people that are, predominantly shopping on social media in one category, but then going to consumer reports and more traditional channels in another. And so how consumers are coming across brands in their shopping process is also quite different. So the forces that are sort of impacting this, the shopper promiscuity, were really accelerated during COVID. So it began with online shopping. And as people got more comfortable with that, more comfortable with innovation and disruption, I should also say that we're used now to categories being disrupted, right? Warby Parker, Uber, Airbnb. It's not unusual anymore for us to find a new way to get a product as well. So as all of that's been coming along, people are getting more promiscuous, more open to new brands, entering into the shopping experience, going from undecided to decided with a very open mind. What's really interesting about this is that this isn't a trend. Our data clearly shows that this is an inflection point in time defined by pre-online shopping and post-online shopping. The people that are growing up in a digitally native world, Gen Zs, their brand loyalty is incredibly low in comparison to boomers and Gen X and millennials who have adopted to this new way of shopping, but are still carrying some old traditions and patterns. But we're trying to be the canary in the coal mine to say that the generations coming after, the generation of Gen Z and the generations coming after them are growing up in this very promiscuous environment, and the way that they think about shopping and brands and the importance of brands is fundamentally changing.
Oh my gosh, so much. I'm furiously taking notes. I mean, I was going to ask, you jumped into it, about the generational differences, like if we felt like that was a factor. That makes so much sense to me because as you're talking about distribution channels, you know, when I was a kid, there was no online shopping. There was no online. There was no social media. So now those adding those different distribution channels and opening up these direct-to-consumer brands like Warby Parker, like Dollar Shave Club, who couldn't sell direct to a consumer, you know, 15, 20 years ago, now can. It makes a lot of sense that there would be a lot of generational differences between between that brand loyalty. The innovation piece is super interesting to me. How, you know, when you think about the different products that are on the shelves, let's stick with grocery store. You mentioned pancake mix. Like we talk to a lot of companies on this show, or, you know, out in the marketplace, out in the insights, that are really shortening their innovation cycles and trying to get these minimally viable products on the shelves very quickly, right? So you're seeing new products emerge within 6 months, 8 months instead of 4 years. And what that creates as a consumer is so many more options, so many like really interesting innovations that would never have made it to shelf if 100% sure this is going to be successful. And on the flip side of that, I mean, I end up buying a lot of products that in 6 months, I can't find them anymore. They don't exist anymore because those innovation cycles and these companies are really trying to be disruptive and try different things and get new products on the shelves. And, you know, you see that playing out in that way. I don't even know what my question is in there. There's just why is it that, is it that speed and that you know, trying to stand out, has that become the new way to win as opposed to brand loyalty is like being that new thing opposed to allowing another competitor to come in and swoop that market share from you?
I mean, I think that's a really fascinating take, Jen, is the role that brands themselves have played in increasing this sort of, path towards promiscuity. And I want to clarify, too, that we don't see this as a trend. This isn't a trend that's going to come and go. This is a rewiring of shoppers' brains that's happening. And we don't quite know what the end result of that is going to be. We're in the middle of that process. So, yes, brands have gotten much better at innovating quickly, getting products onto the shelves, iterating and refining and evolving and doing all of that in real time with customers. And the pressure on them, right, to become profitable right away. These small companies that are going up against the big CPG brands are, you know, scrappy, trying different techniques and tactics, moving outside of even traditional CPG purchasing channels. So it is kind of chaotic. And from the consumer's point of view, one of the things that we've also seen with shoppers is that the number of sources that they use to make a decision, and again, this could be a decision about pancake mix or toaster oven or car, the number of sources that they use to inform that decision has doubled since 2010. And in our data, 76% of shoppers said that they want to be as informed as possible before making a decision. What all of this chaos and noise and exposure to new things has done is created kind of an anxiety-ridden shopper that wants to make sure that they are making the best choice out there. In the past, I mean, I grew up pre-digital, right? So you would go to Sears and you would get a Black & Decker because that was the best product on the market. That was the one that everybody went to. But now there are so many challengers and so many other options. Now I have insecurities and concerns about, well, is that the right one? Maybe there's something really amazing out there that I haven't found, or a better bargain. And it's turning us into these kind of information hungry shoppers to combat that kind of chaos that's happening in the marketplace.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. There is a lot of chaos. So then the question becomes like, how do brands make sense of that? And, you know, as you mentioned about path to purchase, there's no linear path to purchase. People are going kind of all over the place. And, you know, you talk about a struggle to find insights. Well, you know, what's happening there? Is it, you know, a result of that chaos that we're seeing?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, I started my career right before the dot-com boom took off. And so I've had the advantage of being able to see how our industry has responded to online shopping and how we've reacted. And, you know, I would say probably like the first decade or so was really focused on sort of tacking on, like, here's my existing model, but here's the online version, or here's how we're going to accommodate online, but sort of like, you know, duct taping online to existing models. And I would say in the last 10 years, it's been more about methodologies, trying to find unique methodologies to help uncover these insights and UX and all of these new digital tools that we have, and qualitative going virtual in many ways has expanded things. Neuroscience is getting better. So our methodologies are helping us. But one of the things that we talk about in the book is, you know, kind of my soapbox about the purchase funnel, that the purchase funnel was designed 100 years ago in an environment where consumers were incredibly constrained. They only had a certain number of places they could buy products. There were only a certain number of products on the shelf. And so we created this model of, you know, awareness, familiarity, consideration, purchase, you know, trial, and then loyalty. And even though the world around us has changed dramatically, I think that we as an industry are still very centered on that concept, on the purchase funnel. And one of the things that our research has shown over and over again over the last decade is that that purchase funnel is not how people go through their shopping process. Maybe it wasn't actually how they did it at all, but because things were so constrained, the model kind of worked. But now that model doesn't work. But when we look at all of the research that we're doing, particularly around brand tracking, we are still very centered on the purchase funnel and understanding how people go through the purchase funnel. And that is sort of our take on what we're calling this brand narcissism. So the joke that I like to say is that it's sort of like being out on a date with a needy boyfriend or a girlfriend, you know, like, how did you hear about me? Tell me what you think about me. How do I compare to your other girlfriends? Would you go out with me again? What are my best qualities? Like, that's how we're talking to consumers. None of that bears any relevance to how they make their decisions. So we feel like there is a misalignment between the insights that brands are getting, the quality of those insights, the accuracy of those insights, and then what is actually happening in the shopper's brain as they're going through that decision process.
Yeah, I see the obsession with the funnel, like across all different types. I think every company that has a product or service that they're selling to a human being has some sort of purchase funnel. And that can be whether it's CPG or a B2B environment, or like even our, like we all have a funnel. And I wonder if like, why do you think we are having such a hard time letting it go? You know, I think the chaos you described is really hard to put any kind of metrics against or measure success against. Do you think that's why we're, you know, or is it just like we don't have anything to replace it with, or is it just that's what we know is this funnel and people are just having a hard time letting that go?
Yeah, I mean, it is, there's certainly comfort in the funnel. And it's what people were taught in school and what they learned mm-hmm. coming up in their career. And so, you know, there's an innate sort of attachment to it, right? Which makes sense. But to us, it comes down to brands have to do very specific research to their category and to their consumer to understand how they're thinking. So we do a lot of work with brands on understanding the tension between promiscuity and loyalty. How many people in this category are promiscuous? And it really does change category to category. The most loyal category I've ever seen is soda, where 97% mm-hmm. of people have a brand and they buy that brand because mm-hmm. we're all loyal to our soda brands. Now, the market share of the category is declining as people move out into other beverages, but within that group, it's very loyal. On the other hand, you can have categories where there's, you know, sub 20% loyalty in them. So first of all, understanding, you know, what category are you operating in? How are people approaching this category? And then where does your brand sit among that? Are people over-indexing or under-indexing on promiscuity with your brand? What are the things that are driving them towards other brands? How are they getting intercepted and interacting with them? So I think it's about asking the questions to uncover what's happening in your category and then your brand's position in the category. And then from there, you know, we might be able to start building some frameworks or adjusting frameworks to accommodate. But until we understand that perspective, it becomes quite hard to glean the insights from more traditional questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting about the soda. That doesn't surprise me. It's that whole, you know, I'll have a Diet Coke. Oh, we have Pepsi. Is that okay? You know, they I think even made an ad campaign about it. But then the brand narcissism piece that you described, I mean, I see it all the time, right? It's all questions about me, about my brand, about my company, my product. Tell me more about me, and less about asking the consumers, about them and their experiences and just trying to get to know them a bit better. We just last week had Mark Schaefer on the show talking about exactly that. Like, it's not about your why, your as the company, right? It's about their why. It's about understanding why they care and need and, you know, go after and purchase your product versus, you know, why you do what you do, right? So what are some tips that you have to kind of get out of that brand narcissism and get better insights, you know, in a more consumer-centric way?
The first thing I would do is take a look at how much of your research is done among intenders versus people that have just purchased. We really focus on recent purchasers, as close to purchase as we can get, depending on the category, who can walk us through exactly what they did and why they did it and how they ended up at the result they did. A lot of research is done among intenders, people intending to buy in the next 3 to 6 months to 2 years if it's a car. And so those people are answering those questions in hypotheticals. I mean, I'd consider a Honda. I mean, Honda's a good brand. Sure, why not? But do they ever look at Honda when they get into the actual shopping process? So, you know, asking people questions on hypotheticals about what they may or may not do, I think is dangerous when it comes to understanding how people are shopping your category. So first of all, look at that research and see how much of it is among people that have actually done the thing that you're trying to understand. And then also take a look at the questions that you're asking. Are you asking about the consumer's needs, their priorities, their problems, what this is going to solve for them, how they made the determination that this was new, as opposed to asking them questions that your marketers may want to know or your brand managers may want to know, but don't really reflect why this decision is important to them or what drove that with the consumer. And then, you know, we're always big fans of multimodal. I think that there is a lot of heart and head involved in the shopping decision process, and the funnel tends to be very rational focused, head focused. And there are a lot of emotional things that happen during that process too. So multimodal research can also help you kind of uncover and pull out some of those other triggers or barriers that might be happening in the category.
Yeah, that's a good tip. Do you think that, you know, we hear all the time that researchers are so strapped for time and so under pressure, and they've got like these questions from the marketing team that they need to answer. How do you recommend kind of prioritizing some of these broader questions that help to answer those questions that they have in front of them? But, you know, how do you prioritize the stuff that's maybe a little bit more broad, a little bit more about empathy for that buyer, as opposed to answering that specific marketing or product or innovation question?
Yeah. I mean, we really, really counsel our clients that that's where it has to start. It has to start at that sort of bigger picture. If we don't understand the bigger sort of environment or the context in which things are happening, then, you know, going straight into the details of things, we're maybe not asking the right questions or putting it in the right kind of context. So we do a lot of big question work. Some of this has been published, so I can talk about it. Like, we did a study with Snapchat on the role of friendship during, you know, a COVID era of, you know, virtual communication, and kind of how are people navigating that and working with that. We do a lot of those kinds of sort of big meatier questions that then really give us a much more tactical and focused approach going into the next phase of that. So definitely don't be afraid of some of the bigger research. And that doesn't mean it's, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars. It can be very focused, and you can do, you know, really great kind of big picture research. We also have worked with clients where we've just taken their secondary research they've already done, and mined that from this perspective to help give them a sense of what's happening in the category. So there are a lot of ways to tackle it, but I do think that sort of the fundamental of, like, what do our shoppers need when they are looking in our category? What is the thing that is driving them to make that purchase? Emotional, rational, whatever it may be. Got to start there before you can start figuring out how to serve them.
Totally. And I mean, one of the things you mentioned earlier was brand tracking. And, you know, does that kind of fit in with that bigger picture work that you guys are doing or that you would recommend someone do help to kind of get ahead on some of those more specific questions?
Yeah. I mean, we've got a whole chapter on brand tracking in the book about, but kind of the challenges with it, right, in the category. There are, you know, I don't know if you'll ever come across anybody who, if they were answering honestly, would say that they love brand tracking or that they've gotten great insights from brand tracking. I think it's a, you know, everybody kind of agrees it's flawed. And so, you know, what we try to do again is revert to the audience first rather than talking to intenders. We talk to purchasers. Rather than asking them funnel questions, we ask them questions about what they did and why. And so we are coming back with kind of like a, here's how people are shopping in the category right now at this moment. And here are the ways that they're making the decisions. Here are the barriers that they're coming across and how you need to adapt to those. Here's how they're responding or receiving your marketing communications. So I think it's, you know, if I could say anything, my first recommendation would be to try to do some parallel research. I know giving up a brand tracker is hard or adjusting a brand tracker is hard, but try to do some parallel research around like what shoppers are actually doing in the category at the moment. And then comparing that with the data that you get from the brand tracker and seeing like, you know, what different insights are you getting or how should that be adjusted? And then that data can be trended over time in the same way that a brand tracker could.
Yeah, that's a great tip, the parallel research, because you're right, people do have a hard time letting go of brand trackers, almost as hard as getting rid of the funnel, right? The purchase doing so, and that maybe that's a good tip too for evaluating the you know, purchase decisions, is instead of like do some sort of parallel non-funnel with your funnel and a parallel brand tracker with your brand tracker and try to move to a, you know, to the way that people are actually buying and making decisions today, as opposed to the way it's always been done.
Yeah. I mean, you know, each client has their own internal culture and the way that they deal with insights and rely on insights. So I think the way that that would work best is different for every organization. What we're trying to do is just sort of, you know, acknowledge that the way that we're thinking about research and how we're thinking about shopping and the decisions that people make, and, you know, we're coming at it from a brand centric point of view. And I think that we, you know, that leads to an opportunity to miss what else is going on out there.
That's so important to, you know, look outward as opposed to inward. And I mean, just to that point about culture, like what role do the others in the organization, the executives, any marketers, like any non-researchers that are interacting with the insights, what role do they have in kind of helping to make that shift?
Yeah, it's big. I mean, you know, I think that, you know, a lot of it is about orienting those other parts of the company to understand why the data is meaningful to them. So we do a lot of work post project with clients, helping them sort of evangelize the data, bring other people on board, position the data in a way that those folks understand why it's meaningful to them and what they need to do out of it. I think that's really, really critical. And, you know, kind of why I often talk about my company as a consultancy in a way, because yes, we do research. That's the core of what we do. But a lot of what else we do is helping our clients really navigate this very important information. We understand that a lot of our approach is going to be different than they're used to with other research companies. It's not sort of a standard deck that you can get and flip through and say, yeah, I got it. We really have to bring people along. So that's a big part of it is, I think, speaking to the UX team, the product development team, the marketers, all of those folks in a way that they're going to understand why it matters to them in the same way that brands should speak to shoppers in the way that it matters to those shoppers.
Oh my gosh. I find it so interesting how sometimes we have a hard time doing our like research on our internal audiences, right? Like We talk a lot about storytelling and the importance of speaking the right language to the audience. And sometimes it's hard to know, you know, when it comes to your internal stakeholders, like I need to position this in a way that my finance team cares about it, or my marketing, or like, what is the one insight? There's so much data that teams have access to, and there is a level of positioning and storytelling that needs to happen with those internal teams too.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And again, that varies by client and kind of how they're set up. You know, if you're delivering insights to a startup company that is very metric based and, you know, then that's very different than more of a legacy company. So yeah, I think it's about being adaptive and understanding the culture in which the information is going to be received, and then making sure that it's packaged in a way that people can hear it.
Yeah, amazing. And can you tell our audience how they can get your book?
Yeah, sure. I'm not a good salesperson, so... but anywhere books are sold, you can get it. It's on, you know, Amazon. It's on our publisher's page. Our website, Kogan Page, is the name of the publisher. There's a you know, Kindle version, of course, and then paperback and stuff. And then also the first chapter of our book is available for free on our website. So if you go to alteragents.com, you can download the first chapter for free and see what you think.
Awesome. We'll put some links in the show notes so you guys can get access to the book and learn more about brand narcissism and shopper promiscuity. It's super interesting stuff and, you know, so relatable, whether you're on, you know, an insights team or you're a consumer that's shopping in the grocery store. Like, it just, it's so relatable and so tangible. So I really thank you for coming on the show today and talking us through.
Thank you for having me, Jen. It's been fun. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. And thanks everybody for listening in today. We're going to be back for another, double week, another episode tomorrow. We're going to be speaking with positioning expert, author of Obviously Awesome, April Dunford. Very excited. See you then.